Siren Radio.
Just when you thought they weren't actually going to get there. But they did. Don't worry, Gabriella. It wasn't as bad as the United States of America thrashing Thailand 13-0. Of course, that was the Women's World Cup. Gibraltar managed to actually hold, I thought, a fairly respectable Republic of Ireland score of just, I think, 2-0, was it? I think it was just 2-0.
Yeah, not bad.
Yeah, exactly. So, the mighty imps of Gibraltar, those Lincoln imps, are obviously moving along and will continue to do so. So great stuff there. Now, it is Holly Norton's first time in the Siren Radio Studios, actually co-hosting the Midweek Drive Morning Edition. So, Gabriella, I know it's a long, 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 long time ago when you actually made your debut, but have you got any thoughts or questions before we go into that meteorological line? Yeah, but you are. You're eminent grise. Now, you're not. We don't use the O word. We're just chronologically gifted, Gabri. That's the key thing. So that's the important thing.
I'm still in my mid-20s.
Yeah. That's right. And fight for it, my girl. Enjoy it while it lasts. That's the important thing. Anyway, have you got any thoughts you'd like to share with Holly Norton, who, as we said, not chemist, but more biologist, come geographer, specialising in?
At the moment, I'm specialising in reconstructing past climates. And looking at the relationship with diseases.
And in the reconstruction of those past climates, you see what we've done here, Gabriella. It ties you neatly into something which I know Holly was really keen to find out, which is what is the weather forecast for Lincoln, England, when viewed from the perspective of Gibraltar, just off Spain? Exactly. Go for it, Gabriella.
It's not it's besides Spain, but it's a British territory.
Very true.
Just keeping that.
Nicely done.
The weather for Lincoln today is highs of 14 degrees centigrade, lows of 10 degrees centigrade, and it will be a day of light showers with moderate breezes.
Live from Gibraltar, with or without her faithful friend Frodo, it's time for Gabriella Peralta on the Midweek Drive Morning Edition.
And if you're interested, Gabriella, I want to actually check out the evening Midweek Drive from yesterday, you'll find Philip Hurdwood does a reprise of his wonderful tale of his most memorable voiceover work. We just heard it there. It wasn't, surprisingly, doing that one for your good self, Gabriella, in Gibraltar. It was when he actually portrayed a lettuce leaf. Anyway, let us move on. It's 4.5 minutes past 8 o'clock. Gabriella, whom would you like to chat to before we find out about the 50th anniversary of the closure of the Gibraltar Chronicle, in which the Gibraltar Chronicle's already actually shared and published?
The closure of the Gibraltar border.
Yes, exactly. So,
yeah, Chronicle.
How do I cope, Gabriella? I mean,
I wouldn't be working there.
That's very true, yes. You're quite right. The Gibraltar Chronicle is still in existence. It hasn't closed, but the border 50 English years ago, or indeed Spanish years ago, did actually close. So there we are. Do you feel happier since it closed, or is it just a case of, we don't know these days? I mean, it's opened,
since then. Yeah, it's reopened 13 years later and fully reopened 16 years after. The border closing, which was something that a lot of people don't know about internationally, because it wasn't something that, although there was...
Let's just test that one, Gabby. Let's turn to Josephine. Were you aware in any way, shape or form, are your children aware of the closure of Gibraltar, or indeed where Gibraltar is?
As a geographer, I would like to say that I know where Gibraltar
There was a slight test there. I thought I'd throw it at you, yeah.
But no, I didn't know much about the political side of it.
Okay. Fergus.
No, I didn't.
In fact, actually, there are only three people in the studio. We've got three microphones. Why not have your own microphone, Josephine? It's all important. Exactly. You can celebrate your genuine sort of qualifications of that sort of things. And Holly?
Again, as a geographer, I would also like
you would
to
know
say
it where.
I know where it is.
Exactly.
But no, I didn't know much about the borders either.
Yeah. So tell us, Gabriella, share with us some information for the Lincoln listener and more.
Okay, so at the time, Spain was under dictatorship, so they had General Franco at the head. And as always, relations with your neighbours, it happens with every single country, well, practically a lot of them, aren't the best. So at the time, they really wanted Gibraltar back. Remember, Gibraltar's been British for 300 years, and before that it was Spanish, and it was even part of Morocco at some point in our history. So there's always that thorn with Gibraltar that the Spanish want the rock back. Gibraltar is a 3 miles by 1.5 size territory. We're tiny, and we've got about 3,000 people now living on the rock. So it is a small place. So can you imagine if you shut the border with the only land frontier that you've got? So you're stuck. You've locked people in 3 miles. So that's what Gibraltar lived in. Everything at the time in Gibraltar was either blown over, so all our food, can you imagine anything and everything to run an entire country, was either flown over or ferried over from Morocco. Morocco was a great help to us in that time. They gave us food, fresh fruit, vegetables, which obviously couldn't be flown over because especially.
And we like to feel that post Brexit, whatever happens, then Morocco will also be a friend to Gibraltar. Only kidding. Let's not go there.
Yeah, Morocco is a friend to Gibraltar.
Good.
Actually,
that's what we like to hear.
We have good history, and a lot of people from Morocco did travel to Gibraltar because we had loads of gaps in our labour, because a lot of Gibraltar has always had and still has to this day a lot of cross border workers. So a lot of people from Spain will work in Gibraltar, and they I think right now there's about 14,000 working in Gibraltar from Spain, so that's about, you know, half our population, so it's a lot. So can you imagine overnight the border shuts, you go into work, and
it would almost be like turning up at the University of Lincoln, wouldn't it, really? You know, whoa.
Your colleagues aren't there and you can't see them.
No.
For the next 13 years of your life, your family as well. Because, you know, you had cousins, parents. My grandparents ran to Gibraltar because they were living in Spain, but their daughters had married all Gibraltarian men. Mm. And that's never a problem because it's right beside each other.
But it is, you know, if they close the borders and say you're barred. Gibraltar.
But as they had to, my grandparents had to sell their house for cash and run over.
And with such things, clearly, that's the kind of motivation to build a wall across Mexico. Let's not go there.
I don't ever believe in
building walls, precisely. As the geographers would actually say.
I think our history proves right in many different places and countries that it's you shouldn't close places off. It's not good for anyone. It was not good for Gibraltar, even though we thrived, but it was also really not good for La Línea, the city beside Gibraltar, because they really did suffer economically, because so much of the inhabitants of that city worked here that unemployment just shot up overnight, and people, 40,000 people from La Línea, ran to Madrid. So they left the city. And the city really struggled, and it's something that 50 years later is still felt in La Línea.
There we are, so, and you provided a wonderful Midweek Drive Morning Edition supplement to the print edition, which you can also get online from the Gibraltar Chronicle, which is awesome. Gabriella, have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us on the programme today?
I have, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Are you going to join us again in a fortnight's time? Because next week we'll be at the Lincolnshire Show, unless you want to fly over and join us there.
I can't, but enjoy. Best of luck at the show.
This is true, exactly. And we will speak again in, let's face it, about 320 hours or so from now. You're supposed to say yes. It's there. By the way, is Frodo still functioning?
Yes, he is. He's well and good.
Frodo's a pug, by the way, in case you're wondering. Lives with Gabriella's parents. It's a good relationship. No borders there. Marvellous. Where you wander among every culture and tongue. It's chaotic, but hey, it's home. When the wind's from the east and the sun's from the west and the sand in the glass is right, come on down, stop on by, hop a carpet and fly to another Arabian night.
the streets at the fabled bazaars with the cardamom-cluttered stalls. You can smell every spice while you haggle the price of the silks and the satin shawls. Oh, the music that plays as you move through a maze in the haze of your pure delight. You are caught in a dance, you are lost in the trance of another Arabian night. Arabian nights, like Arabian days. More often than not, are hotter than hot in a lot of good ways. Arabian nights, like Arabian dreams. This mystical land of magic and sand is more than it seems. There's a road that may lead you to good or to grief, through the power your wish and command. Let the darkness unfold or find fortunes untold. Well, your destiny lies in your hands.
Only one creator here, one whose worth lies far within, the diamond in the rough.
Arabian Nights. Take off and take flight to shock and amaze. Arabian nights, neath Arabian moons. A fool off his guard could fall and fall hard out there on the dunes.
The courageous and self-determined Princess Holly, featured obviously within The Joys of Aladdin, a movie to actually catch and see, primarily to actually get rid of the taste of Godzilla King of Monsters. Of course, we're talking Princess Jasmine, but I don't know, could be Princess Holly, I suppose. Could be. Yeah. It's head of schools listening.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind.
Have a magic carpet, you know, let's put our faith in magic as opposed to various other bits and pieces.
I guess if you could fly, you'd avoid the traffic. So.
Exactly. And Will Smith, well, just awesome. So, but what do our words care when you have Richard Fitzwilliams, our Ace Film Critic, online? Richard, over to you.
Well, I can only say that when I heard I was seeing a film directed by Guy Ritchie.
Your favourite, my favourite, Man from U.N.C.L.E. personified.
Yes. Now, why was it that after making Revolver, he didn't shoot himself? I always wondered, you know, that question. And then there was King Arthur, a film so terrible that words failed most critics. I mean, they really couldn't describe how awful it was. Here, I mean, the only thing really to emphasize with Aladdin, another live-action take on the 1992 Disney movie, and if you're really interested, it's the same voice who plays Abu, Aladdin's faithful monkey. But nonetheless, the main thing is the fans absolutely love it. I was looking at the rating, whereas the critics are divided. This is a movie that's pretty critic-proof. Yes, if you want to overdo it, you call in Guy Ritchie. But luckily for this movie, luckily it does have charm in the person of the chemistry between the lovers. I mean, that is terribly important. And we meet Aladdin, a young street urchin who steals with his pet monkey Abu, and he rescues Princess Jasmine, played by Naomi Scott. Aladdin is Mina Masood, and she's exploring the city, and he's chased by the guards, and the Grand Vizier Jafar is the evil one. Marwan Kanzari plays him. He has a macaw. Princess Jasmine has, in fact, Raja, a Bengal tiger, so animals have quite a role in this movie, and of course, there's the Sultan, in theory, Princess Jasmine's father on the throne, but it's the evil Jafar who wants to become the most powerful man in the kingdom and replace him. Well, what happens? You have to actually get to the Cave of Wonders. It's not a Cave of Wonders, actually. It's Guy Ritchie at his most terrible, and it's very overdone, but nonetheless, it is a lamp, and out of the lamp can come the genie, and the genie can give you three wishes, or you can, wait, go and see the
Richard,
movie.
Richard, it might just be the weather. It might just be the weather, or it might just be the kind of the inclement scenario. But I get a slightly jaundiced suggestion from yourself. I get a feeling of a weariness about this. I get the feeling that it didn't fill you with joy and delight somehow. Is that fair to say?
Well, the thing is, I mean, I do feel that the two actors, I didn't know either Mena Massoud or Naomi Scott. In fact, there were...
It's a whole new world.
I'm sorry?
It's a whole new world.
A whole new world. I mean, the sets were certainly very, very spectacular. The problem with the movie was the lack of magic. I mean, yes, Will Smith as the genie thoroughly enjoyed himself overacting, and there's absolutely no question about it. This movie really, I mean, it is a spectacular and opulent Eiffel. There's even Prince Ali's procession of 1,000 dancers. I mean, the music isn't that distinguished, the musical. I mean, the point with this movie is I did quite enjoy it, but I came out feeling that Guy Ritchie had been involved
in it.
I know
your ultimate dream team is Guy Ritchie directing Keira Knightley in a version of Lawrence of Arabia. So, yeah, it'll happen.
That is what will one day be.
Exactly.
No, it's not bad. I mean, the point is the fans love it, and so from that point of view, you've got magic of a sort and certain scenes conspicuously lacking in it, but it is what it is. It's Disney's live-action movies, so they're absolutely brilliant ideas, since I didn't see the cartoon originals, since it did not happen to appeal to me. I have to say, Aladdin...
Okay, let's do a quick round, Robin. In the studio, Fergus, Aladdin, will you be taking Richard's view? Will you be taking Phil Leonis's view yesterday, or will it be a case of maybe?
I'm coming to undecided, really. Undecided. The trailer didn't sell me, but I may still go and check it out.
Okay.
What did Phil say, by the way?
You don't want to hear it. He's not a fan of Guy Ritchie. It's very sad. It's online. Yeah. I feel as though I need to sort of redress the balance for the former Mrs. Madonna. Or rather, Mr. Madonna. Anyway. Josephine?
I'll be taking my two kids to go and watch
Excellent.
It.
So, excellent. Very good.
Yeah, we'll get a review from an 8-year-old.
Nice.
Which will be nice.
Yeah. And Holly, you saw the trailer. Does it appeal to yourself?
Not particularly. I can't say it particularly sold me, which is a shame because it was one of my favourite Disney films.
We'll be finding about Holly's scientific work with respect to geography of the planet in times past as the programme proceeds. Meanwhile, Richard, which bookish area would you like to take us to now?
Booksmart, directed by Olivia Wilde, and it's another and an enjoyable Well, I have to say, another of these coming-of-age movies, a lot of them recently, and the best being Eighth Grade, which I really loved. The point is, I'm sure that no member of the team fall into the trap that Amy and Molly at the beginning of this movie have. Amy is played by Caitlin Dever, Molly is played by Beanie Feldstein, and it's, again, the chemistry between them that makes this movie very likable, punchy, it's lively, it's I thoroughly enjoyed it. They are two high school seniors. They are devoted to work, and one night before they graduate, they want to let themselves go, and they want to go to a variety of, or one party in particular, but they end up doing a great deal more than that. Molly is urging Amy to have a relationship with Ryan, the girl she's attracted to. What happens? How does the movie develop? The point is, you've got quite witty dialogue. You've got two very likable characters. You've got them going to a series of parties whilst they're trying to find Nick's party, and, well, all sorts of amusing, often scatological dialogue, an absolutely priceless lesbian scene in a bathroom. I leave that to the imagination of...
I'm glad you did, Richard. It is early in the morning. People are still having their cornflakes.
No, it is very, very amusing, though. I have to say, I roared at laughter at that. And, well, if there's a pizza man, I have to say, be careful who you get a lift with.
So if Olivia actually wins an Academy Award for this, is she going to produce another embarrassing, gushing kind of line for that? Oh, that's Olivia Colman. Don't worry. I just wanted to clarify that.
I think that you've confused
the
honestness. I can't quite understand how. In fact, I think that's one of the weirdest comments that you made, but I must absolutely welcome the marvellous CD that Olivia Colman has deservedly gotten. I can't wait for the next series of The Crown, and it's a good opportunity to pay tribute to her in The Night Manager, in Tyrannosaur, and obviously in The Favourite. And I was thrilled at that.
We didn't, of course, put the question to the team, will they be checking out that book movie? Have you seen the trailer, Holly?
Yeah. I have seen the trailer, yeah. And I've heard a lot of good things about it, mm-hmm. but it's maybe not the kind of thing that I go and see in the cinema, so I might wait until it's out on DVD or something.
Yes, you don't admittedly need the widescreen, but I always recommend it if it's possible.
Fair point. Josephine, is it a case of no? Personally, I prefer to actually watch the flooding of a bridge in Horncastle as opposed to going and see that movie.
Yeah, pretty much. My favourite movies are definitely like big natural disaster movies, and we actually have on a Friday night.
Our very own natural disaster.
Godzilla, for example, is that?
Yeah. Put away. Step. Take those very large reptilian feet and step aside, Richard, from the King of the Monsters and so on.
No, I really couldn't cope with it. I mean, there was no way. Really, we have to draw lines somewhere.
Yeah.
Somewhere.
Well, Robin Pearce liked it, so, you know, it just goes to show. Welsh film critics can sometimes differ. What about yourself, Fergus?
I don't know. I may check it out at the cinema. I may wait until it comes out on
Netflix. Bit of ambivalence, I think, from our...
Well, I mean, it's thoroughly enjoyable, but we have had... it's a very popular genre at the moment, and it's... it depends on the actor.
But how many teenage coming-of-age movies can you actually... How many do we need, for goodness sakes? Or is it like superhero movies?
The point is that it's great fun, for example. The relationship between them, they both have Malalas, because Malala is the phrase that one of them uses for unconditionally doing what the other wants to do. It's great fun. I mean, you know, you have a Malala, so your friend has to follow what you want to do, and then they have their Malala, and it's
let's just test this with the kids on the street, so to speak, the PhD souls on the street, shall we say. Holly, you know, Malala, is that something you could get down with over in the think tank every so often, say, I'm Malala this?
I mean, it's not a term I've ever heard, but no. It sounds like it could be a fun idea once in a while.
Joe, Malala?
No, never heard of it before.
No.
It's in the smoothie, but the point is, you have your Malala, and then your friend, you know, does what you want, and then they have their Malalas, and so forth. What if you break a Malala? I mean, it's a bit of fun.
What about Leicester? Do the Malala people in Leicester?
No, not really, no.
There we are. I was thinking it might be just a Lincoln thing. Let's move on, Richard, very briefly. Trooping of the Colour, birthday honours. Obviously, Duke of Edinburgh is now 98 years. He's getting ever closer to that, getting a congratulatory telegram from his wife.
That's true, and I mean, I have to say, obviously he celebrated privately, but no question it is a landmark, and we're very, very lucky. In the last year, the Iron Duke became the Duke of Hazzard, as you well recall, and that was, I mean, how he escaped from that crash is very, very fortunate, but it's also very, very fortunate that no one was really seriously injured, including the child in that car, and it has been a year. It's always good to see him when he decides to appear. For example, the Order of Merit lunch was the most recent Windsor that he appeared at, and when we don't know when he's going to appear, it gives it a cachet, and of course he's no stick. It's absolutely amazing.
Well, you see, it just goes to show what can happen if, in the words of David Icke, you happen to be descended from a late lizard reptilian species from a different planet. But there we are, by the way.
That is a strange point, I think, that you should put it to Guy Ritchie. I must also say, Trooping the Colour, there's no question. I mean, Louis absolutely loved the planes and so forth.
Well, Louis is actually, I don't think, that much older than Josephine's children, I would have thought. I mean, were they interested in the Trooping of the Colour?
I don't think I told them about it.
Unbelievable. Sometimes.
Well, it's always splendidly colourful, and you've got...
Hence the name, really. Monochrome, it'd be a lot more grey.
But it's interesting, I mean, historically, where you had this idea of... the colour distinguishing your army or your regiment from the enemy. I you recall, Alex, the Battle of Barnet, Shakespeare, the envious mist that so deceived their sight, where the Earl of Warwick's soldiers set upon each other, he was known as the Kingmaker beforehand, during the Wars of the Roses.
That's part and parcel of the fact that, as Einstein once said, past, present and future, they're just stubborn illusions. Everything's happening at the same time. Ian Lennox is lined up in a few seconds to actually go and develop a whole variety of other bits and pieces. And then we're talking about the sad news that, as far as small businesses are actually concerned, Brexit contingency plans and stockpiling may have caused a false dawn among Britain's small businesses. Confidence, apparently, amongst SMEs at the end of the year has all but disappeared.
Incidentally, perhaps someone could explain to me about those different votes in Parliament, because every time I looked at I saw there was a different result.
Yeah.
I mean, it's getting to a stage, it got to a stage a long time ago.
Richard, we have succeeded. We are now actually beating the United States when it comes to politics in becoming the laughingstock of the world. So congratulations.
Yes, I'm afraid that's the case.
Off. That's had some seriousness
it is.
About
it's that. Absolutely bizarre. Hmm. I mean, there's no precedent for it, and you think, well, you remember what things. I was in Parliament actually a couple of days ago just to visit a friend. I have to say that looking around, you could see why it needed a refurbishment, but that too is going to be something that will cost the taxpayer.
I think they should come to Lincoln, actually. I mean, we can put them up at the university.
Well, Buckingham Palace, of course, is undergoing a £369 million refurbishment over 10 years.
Let's restore Lincoln to what it used to be under the Romans, the capital of the country, the biggest port, Lindum and so on. Let's make sure that the world will come to our fine East Midlands location.
There. I didn't know Lincoln was the capital. I thought it was Londinium under the Romans.
Have you
been playing with history? Did you
playing
teaser?
With history?
Did you do that sort of tantalising inverted commas fact, which isn't? Did you try and get that past me? To sneak it past me?
I think we'll have to have a historical debate about such issues in terms of where things were going, etc. There are many Romans at the time who say this is the country's capital. Let's move on. Have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us today, Richard Fitzwilliams?
I certainly have.
Next week we'll be at the Lincolnshire Show, Richard, and of course it's Royal Ascot. So I suspect we won't be connecting together unless we do a pre-record, which we may do, of course, unless maybe you'd like to join us on the evening slot. We might talk about that for the Wednesday slot.
An evening show is not a good idea at Ascot Week because I'm travelling back.
Well, then we won't do that then. We'll probably see you in a fortnight's time, as we did with Gabriella, and connect from that basis.
That would be a good idea indeed.
Meanwhile, speaking of Malalas... I'm afraid we just have to interject momentarily, Richard, with respect to that. Hopefully, you're still there. Are you still there, Richard? Oh, no, he's gone. Yes, because actually, the official news from Josephine, breaking news, is it wasn't Lindum, it wasn't Londinium, it was...
It was Winchester.
Take you wonder by wonder, over sideways and under on a magic carpet ride. A whole new world, a new fantastic point of view. No one to tell us no, or where to go, or say we're only dreaming.
Unbelievable sights, indescribable feeling, soaring, tumbling.
chase
a wondrous place for you and me.
And it's nice to see we've been joined by Emma Street, who's actually now practicing her new brand of yoga headphone wearing, which entails actually leaning forward to the desk to ensure that maximum sort of karma is actually achieved. Are you okay, Emma?
Yeah.
Are you sure? You're okay for that? That's all right. Ian Lennox is always okay, aren't you, Ian?
Yes. Always.
Always. Ready to score at the door. Marvellous. Two PhD cells in the studio today. Josephine Westlake, who is currently pursuing the studies in which particular field of human endeavour?
So we're looking at reconstructing flood histories using paleo flood records.
So really, weather today is just ideal for you, and yesterday.
Absolutely, it's fantastic.
It's like coming to life.
Not so much for the people in Horncastle. I feel a bit sorry for them.
Yeah, they've got all sorts of other things there, like castles and horns, hence the name. Sorry, they've got a brass band, otherwise I always think it's very amusing, really, from that point of view. And we also have Holly Norton. Holly, of course, your specialism is?
I'm looking at reconstructing past climates and weather systems, and then...
Just a minor point, Holly. I mean, you're eight at Greek history. Move that microphone so he's actually facing yourself. Otherwise, it's just and it irritates Ian no end. Because
he's trying to share.
I know you're trying to share, but ultimately, there ain't no sharing when it comes to media work. You are the star. You go for it, you know? So this is the critical thing. Just share with us one more time, please.
So I'm reconstructing the climates of the last sort of 1,000 years in Lincolnshire, and I'm looking at the effect that had on diseases.
How do you do that?
Yeah. How?
So the main thing that we do is we look at pollen that's contained within the soil. So we take a core of the soil and we look at the pollen and plant remains that are in it. And you can look at the kinds of environments that those plants grew in. So you can then tell what the environment and the climate was like at the time.
You see, that stymied you when you thought we were just going to talk about the United States of America thrashing Thailand by 13-0. We were expecting something completely different. You know.
Something I understand.
Yeah, something way, way down the line from that point of view.
No, I watched a documentary about digging the Chevets and the carbon dated things that they found.
We do carbon dating so that we can date flood deposits as well.
Oh, right.
It's fascinating, actually, some of the things you can find. So one of the ones that I've dated is actually about 22,000 years old.
Wow.
Yeah.
What was that, then? Was it?
So you can find...
almost as old as Ian.
I know. Sorry, Ian.
You're not commenting me, I tell you.
You can find, pollen, like Holly was saying, but you can also find fragments of wood. So through time, sediment gets deposited on top of things that have fallen down onto the ground. You find those and you send them off for carbon dating and you can get those back. They give us quite accurate dates, so it's pretty good.
Wow. Mm. I think when this guy, the archaeologist friend of mine, did this dig, I think if he found things underneath things, that helped. They could date. They could. It was all. They used to date the soil they dated, or sort of specimens of the things that they found.
If you can, it's better to date the whole specimens. So if you find fragments of wood or things like that, it's better. But you can do bulk dating on the sediments. And over in near Torksey, they found some very large wood deposits, so whole tree trunks that had been buried from about the Bronze Age.
God. This this dig I was involved in, two of his students buried a Victorian clay pipe on the grounds, and he found it, and which was going to, if it had been a valid find, it would have destroyed his whole theory.
Yeah, that's not what you want to find when you do.
It only lasted about 30 seconds, wasn't it?
But Joe, they're Geordies. They do all sorts of crazy things up there, you know? It's just the way forward. As you were putting the question to me, Joe, when we announced to you that Ian was joining us for his regular weekly start, do you have a Newcastle connection at all, or is it just because you're just fascinated by what's happening on Tyneside?
No, I'm just interested up there. I mean, there's lots of interesting geology and things going on, and obviously you've got the thing with the clean air tolls, which seems to have been put on hold, so... Obviously, from a geography point of view, that's quite interesting.
Mm.
Right, well, the guy I work with, he reckoned that the Chevets were among the most important archaeological sites in Europe because they're hardly touched. And what had happened was that many years ago in the Dark Ages, there were lots of beasties in the low ground, so the people had actually lived in the hills, basically. And they had about 20,000 people living up in the Cheviots. And obviously the stuff they left behind was of...
So technically it wasn't Winchester at all, it was Cheviots. Cheviots were the capital of the country back in the day. We're just having a debate there. Richard Fitzwilliam is furious. You know, his exposition on the online, when he sort of dared to criticise the notion that it could be Londinium that was capital, outrageously so. Okay, so who do you wish to chat to, Ian, for the next few moments? We've got... She's recovering from her Tottenham debacle after the European Cup final. That's Emma Street. Because Emma's...
Oh, yes, that'll do.
Yeah. Sorry, Fergus, the end of the day.
Sort
of
traveller.
Yes, hello.
Hello, I'm an expert at debacles. I support Newcastle United.
Yeah, you know how it feels then.
I did say, Emma, you play Harry Kane, you lose.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really agree with
England
that.
England found out the same thing, you know, play Harry Kane.
Yeah.
It's not good.
Yeah.
I don't know why he did it. I mean, the guy who replaced it scored a hat-trick, hadn't he, in the previous game?
Lucas Moura, he did the hat-trick that got us through to the final, and then he was benched. I don't really understand the decision behind it, but...
Well, never mind.
I think it was a bad error.
Yeah.
And other of the Spurs team didn't turn about either. So quite a few didn't play very well.
Yeah.
But Kane was just, he looked what he was. He
hopeless.
Looked who hadn't played for
hopeless.
A long time. Well, he looked like he hadn't played for
hopeless
ages.
Hopeless Harry.
It was his first game back, so, yeah.
First, you don't go into the European Cup final, the biggest sort of match of the whole thing. But, oh, I've been poorly. I'm in now, you know. We work these folk in. That's the important thing. Okay, don't forget, Emma, next week you might be able to meet some real stars because some of the Lincoln City football people might be at the Lincolnshire show, and you've got your press pass now because I've emailed it to
I
you.
I do, looking forward to that.
So, Ian,
they're doing very well, Lincoln, aren't they?
Extraordinarily well. They're already into the first division of the English League and will be sharing the same league division as Sunderland. So there we are. Who'd have thought it? So there's Sunderland playing Lincoln, Lincoln playing Sunderland as equals.
Well, I think Newcastle played Lincoln not so long ago, about 15 years ago, when they were in the... then second division.
Well, there you are, you see. It's just a wondrous time by...
I remember it very well because we won.
Fergus, of course, being from Leicester, he has a whole different take on matters when it comes to Brendan Rodgers. Are you looking forward to Brendan Rodgers' work in the new season, or is it a case of, well, we just don't know, after Claudio Ranieri, it's always going to be downhill?
Well, hopefully it'll last more than one season, but I think they've got a good clutch of young players that could be pretty exciting for the upcoming season, definitely.
Do you follow any sport at all, Holly, or is it a case of I dedicate my entire life to the work of geography and pollen analysis and therefore have no time to engage in frivolities?
I mean, it does feel like that sometimes.
True scientist, you know. I know where you're coming from. I was president of the Chemistry Society of the University of London back in the day. Saw some of the photographs recently as well. Good grief, still there. No.
Mostly not really. No. I mean, I follow things like show jumping and judo
Excellent.
As well a little bit. But
so the 3-day event at Bramham would have been of interest to you?
Well, it's quite interesting.
She rides horses.
I do.
It's marvellous. In fact, you could, yes.
Do you ever get bored at your job then?
You know.
No.
Do you have time to get bored?
I mean, I'm only 4 months into it, so yeah. I suppose
doing that
maybe,
PhD
maybe
thing. And what about yourself, Joe? Do you ever sort of suffer from those days? I think not another chemical titration I have to sort of work through, not another resonance scan that we've got to put through the whole system.
I'm over halfway now, so I'm over a year and a half in, and I'm well into the laboratory work. So the exciting stuff.
Another
on the field
ethical approval
over.
Form to actually do.
Well, it's not too much of that because there's not much ethics involved in terms of.
You
mud.
Said it.
In terms of mud, it doesn't really.
Well, I don't know. Has anybody asked the mud? It's a critical thing.
I did find an interesting bone the other day, which we haven't identified yet as to whether it's human or not, so that might have some ethical implications.
We're sort of hoping it's not.
What, really?
Well, it might affect your work if it is.
More interesting
but it would be exciting.
Yeah.
They've started a murder hunt.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think York Council will appreciate it if they have to go and dig up their entire Roundtree Park.
So true. But, you know, that's the appliance of science, as a well-known washing machine used to actually use as a strapline a few years ago. And I don't know why I mentioned them now, but still, in fact, nobody in the studio will remember that slogan, will they? No, the appliance of science, no. No. Ian, do you remember it?
Yes, I do, but I can't remember what it referred to.
Yeah, it's a new C. Anyway, you could YouTube it. You'll find it there. The Appliance of Science. It's great.
Okay.
Not quite as memorable as Forsprung durch Technique, but that was a different line entirely. Ian, have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link?
Yes, I have.
Do you know, I've been asking the questions for most of them these days. Emma, what's the second question we need to put to Ian? Bearing in mind, next week we'll be at the Lincolnshire Show, so it won't be next week. It'll be a fortnight. Off you go.
Okay. Will you be joining us again in a fortnight?
I hope so, and I hope you get the lady gets her bones identified by then.
these are the critical lines, and we'll hopefully sort of not leave that narrative trope hanging for too long, because you'll find that one is connected to the other, and neck bone's connected to the shin bone. And... And Flowers and the Killers with Bones. The number of small and medium-sized enterprises in the United Kingdom has grown by 18% over the past 4 years, equating to an annual growth rate of 5.7%. Now, if we go back further, the number of SMEs rose by 27% between 2010 and 2018. Since 2014, the fastest-growing major sectors include transportation and storage, business administration and financial services. However, we may have some slightly more frustrating news on the horizon, especially given that the SME Health Check Index, recently published, has suggested that the Brexit is having an effect, and there's also persistent low confidence, which is hitting small, medium enterprises. Now, hopefully to talk about that, assuming we've coordinated in all sorts of magical ways, we've got two wonderful fine folk. First of all, the corporate and mid-market director of CYBG. That would be wonderful, Graham Sands. Graham, good morning.
Good morning.
Excellent. And ace economist for the Centre for Economics and Business Research, CBAT, that's Pablo Shah. Good morning, Pablo.
Good morning.
Pablo, if we can come to you first. Is this a case of all of those predictions of doom are likely to be sort of coming to home to roost? Are there issues here? Because let's face it, if it's not for our small, medium enterprises, Britain, as a nation of small shopkeepers, and England in particular, might be in a pretty tricky state in the 21st century.
Yeah, so the Health Check Index fell to a 12-month low in the first quarter of a year. And some of the more concerning findings we had were the revenue indicators. So that's now the weakest it's been since we started collecting data in 2014. There are also more businesses, especially small businesses, that are operating below their full capacity. So these findings suggest that while headline GDP figures were quite strong at the start of the year, a huge part of this is attributable to pre-Brexit stockpiling as opposed to any underlying strength in demand in the economy.
Now, Siren's based in the East Midlands, obviously at the University of Lincoln. Are there any particular findings that kind of stood out from your good self when it comes to the East Midlands of the country and indeed our general location?
Well, the East Midlands actually recorded very strong employment growth in the first quarter of the year. So we saw 44,000 new people enter employment in Q1. So this is the highest growth rate since 2016. So the index actually rose by 4.2 points for the East Midlands region. So it did buck the national trend in that sense.
Graham, just briefly turning to yourself, is this Brexit confusion, which again, we've seen stories where basically people refuse to even access the news now because of the B word that's actually there, is it really having that kind of major impact on businesses across the country? I mean, is this something where if you're in the business routine, you'll think, well, maybe I should just emigrate and move my whole business abroad?
No, I don't think we're seeing businesses think that. I think what we're seeing is one of two different things. The uncertainty that businesses are feeling around about the eventual outcome, we're beginning to see that as being very normalized into the indications that we've been seeing over the last few years. So one good example of that is, well, there was actually a little bit of good news and investment bounced up in the most recent quarter. It was only a little bit, and it was from four consecutive falling quarters. So we read that as a bottoming out of investment from SMEs into the economy. And that's a pretty negative thing for our economy and for those SMEs overall. So what we're really seeing is a Brexit-induced inertia in the numbers, and that's really becoming a bit of a new normal, unfortunately. That's not the same, though, as saying that any impact from Brexit itself is factored into these numbers.
I was intrigued to find that CYBG, obviously your company, predicts that this low confidence and reluctance to borrow could be offset by possible future upticks in consumer confidence, which of course would then build that virtuous circle and increase willingness to fund growth, etc. So maybe, you know, there is light at the end of the tunnel, would you say?
I think we'll just need to wait and see how things play out. As I say, I think that through the phase of uncertainty that we're in just now, I think we're seeing that things have fairly much bottomed out. And we'll just need to wait and see what 31st of October and beyond holds for us.
We've got three postgraduate students, one undergraduate student in the studio with us, two PhD students. Let's go to Josephine first. I mean, I know you're in the science routine, so, but then science is equally sort of impacted by this. Any thoughts or questions you'd like to put to either Graham or Pablo?
Yeah, in terms of small businesses, what's your opinion on the enterprise investment scheme that was introduced? Because there's been some sort of negative and positive reports on how well that's working.
Yes, there's been some negative and some positives round about that.
Does it cancel each other out? Well, superb art saga, right?
Look, I think we do need to have schemes which help people, helps channel private money into smaller businesses. There's no doubt that that helps in every economy across the world where they try something like that. The tax breaks, though, for that do need to be proportionate, and we should as well remember that investing money into small, illiquid companies is a relatively high-risk thing to do. So the people that do that should be well aware of those risks, and I would suggest that that shouldn't be for the mass market, and that's something for those people that are in the fortunate enough position to be able to hold that money patiently in small businesses for a long period of time.
We talk about long periods of time. Of course, Holly, you're dealing, as we found out earlier in the production, with sort of millennia, thousands of years in terms of time.
Yes, mostly the last 1,000 years, but yeah.
Okay,
yeah,
so
very long time period.
Clearly we'll see ups and downs from that particular cycle. Have you got any questions yourself?
I was just wondering if there's any particular sector of small businesses that's more affected than others.
So one of the things that we tracked in this in last quarter's index was the rate of business creation. And generally, the areas that have seen most growth are quite knowledge-intensive service sector areas. So recruitment has grown a lot, manufacturing, but most importantly has been computer programming and IT. So that's really exploded rapidly in the last 4 or 5 years. In terms of manufacturing, there has been slower growth in that sector. So declining industries like the reproduction of printed media, things like that, have been replaced by a strong growth in automotive sectors, and then also the drink sector is doing quite well in the UK.
I suppose it kills the pain. Speaking of drink, as a postgraduate student who doesn't have coffee or indeed tea, as we discovered last night, Fergus, any thoughts from yourself?
So, well, looking at this from the kind of young people who are, like myself, who are going to
work. Faced with this whole situation. Well,
the young people who are going to work, coming off university, who may be thinking to start their own small business. Do you have any advice for them as a result of this report?
I mean, should they be concerned, Graham, about this, or say, what the hey, we're going to go with it in any case?
Well, for first of all, since this is radio, I'd like to pretend I'm also a young person that has exactly the same concerns, and you can't tell any differently.
Indeed, yes.
What I would say, though, is that it's possible there is a period of disruption ahead, but I think we need to set out very clearly if you're setting out into a business career, that is a career that everyone hopes is going to last for 30, 40, maybe even these days 50 years. So what I would say is look at those businesses that are trying to capture market share that's related to the big mega trends that you can see in the economy. So things like demographic change, digitalization or decarbonization. Those are likely to be the businesses which win out over the long term, provided, of course, they can withstand any short-term disruption. So I would look ahead in your career, look ahead 20, 30, 40 years, and try and go with the big trends in industry, in the economy, and in the world.
That sounds better than looking ahead about 1,000 years, which, of course, is what we were talking about as well this morning, but never mind. Where can people go to find out further details about this particular research, Pablo, as far as the CEBR is actually concerned?
If people are interested in finding out a little bit more, they can find it on either the Clydesdale or Yorkshire Bank website, which is cbonline.co.uk or yb.co.uk.
I'm delighted you actually mentioned the acronym of Clydesdale and Yorkshire there, because I'm sure people think, is it cyberspace? Are the computers taking over this as well? No, Clydesdale and Yorkshire Banking Group. Graham Sands, Corporate and Mid-Market Director for aforementioned CYBG, and Pablo Shah, Economist for the Centre of Economics and Business Research. Many thanks indeed. And let's hope then when next we speak, we'll actually have some more positive news from that side of things, at least as far as our SMEs are concerned.
Well, fingers crossed.
money? Who holds the lead? Who holds the strings of misery? Or the pursuit free? And the gunmen weep? Or the gangsters so? And the law is cheap when the smugglers go.
Give us peace in our time. Give us peace in our time.
Sun-kissed rooms in city slums, minds are restless till the airmail comes. From the forest floor to the western mine, or chat your topic or a party line. And the hardest love of all is to forgive, and as the world comes tumbling down.
Give us peace in our time. Give us peace in our time. While I have a life to live, then I have no love to give. Give us peace in our time.
Today, highs of 14 degrees centigrade, lows of 10 degrees centigrade. It's going to be a day of light rain showers with some gentle breezes.
Everybody talks about a new world in the morning. New world in the morning, so they say. Now I myself don't talk about a new world in the morning. New world in the morning, that's today. And I can feel a new tomorrow coming on. And I don't know why I have to make a song. Now everybody talks about a new world in the morning. New world in the morning takes so long. I met a man who had a dream he'd had since he was 20. I met that man when he was 81. He said, too many folks just stand and wait until the morning. Don't they know tomorrow never comes? And he would feel a new tomorrow coming on. And when he'd smile, his eyes would twinkle up and far. Now everybody talks about a new world in the morning. New world in the morning takes so long. And I can feel a new tomorrow coming on. And I don't know why I have to make a sign.
Holidays, we look towards them, we look forward towards them, and we anticipate them, and we work through all sorts of things. What we don't expect, of course, is to be scammed. And new research has actually revealed that 1 in 5 of us have been scammed, or indeed nearly scammed, when booking online. Now, to talk about ways in which we can protect ourselves from cybercrime, especially when booking holidays, we're delighted to welcome Head of Cyber Investigations at McAfee, the wonderful John Focker. How are you, John?
Good morning, good morning.
And ace travel expert from HomeAway, Karen Mullins. How are you, Karen?
I'm good, thank you. Morning.
Excellent. We also have in the studio Professor Fiona Moore. I think it's fair to say, Fiona, you kind of weren't a victim of a holiday scam, but it was kind of like weak business practice, wasn't it, really?
Definitely, yes, but we can talk about that later.
Yeah, okay, well, we might share with that. Karen, this statistic, 1 in 5 British folk have been scammed or nearly scammed, that's pretty high and quite worrying.
Yeah, I find that quite surprising, actually. And John could probably talk more to this. This is research by McAfee on the overall industry. Mm. At HomeAway, we see very, very low numbers.
Okay, John, over to yourself then. I mean, is it just a case of, you know, we book holidays online, you might get it, you might not, you might just lose your money completely?
Well, I'm actually not surprised. And, well, unfortunately, I have to say with that, because... Everybody's looking for a good, cheap deal, and criminals know that, and they try to take advantage of it. End up making holidays a top target as well. Consumers don't want to miss out on a deal. They feel the need to book the cheapest price, and they're forced to book it quickly. And if you don't have the right security measures in place and don't actively check the authenticity of the websites that you visit, you leave yourself open to a number of risks.
And people are still doing that, presumably, actually, going online, not checking various other things. Fiona, you do an awful lot of travelling in your capacity as a senior academic at Royal Holloway, Hong Kong, Singapore, Copenhagen and so on, Dublin. What are your thoughts when you're sort of booking holidays? Well, not holidays, booking flights and
yes.
so on.
Well, actually, that's... I'm more cautious than most in that I will only use websites that I'm reasonably sure of. So, you know, sorry if I'm violating commercial promotions guidelines. So Expedia, Booking.com, Holiday Lettings is another one I use a lot.
HomeAway, obviously.
Yes, HomeAway. Yes, HomeAway as well. Yes, Villa.com. And sometimes... if I'm using a smaller one, it's usually because I've got it through a link off that site. So, for instance, there's actually a sort of a home away for Copenhagen that I use a lot, but I know about that because one of the people I contacted through Holiday Lettings was like, you know, could you book through the local service because it's local? And so, as I said, you know.
Is that an appropriate way to proceed, John, or is Fiona actually sort of being a bit too overconfident there in terms of the sites look realistic and fine and they should be safe accordingly?
Do please tell me.
I do think that is a good practice. We always advocate within McAfee browse with the right site. However, cyber criminals do have a tendency to make an exact copy of certain sites. Mm-hmm. So make sure you access the site in the way that you're familiar with and not be lured in through a fake advertisement through another platform or a direct email. Mm-hmm. And browse with a security protection. So we have a comprehensive security protection solution that also not only protects you from viruses, but also checks if the site is legitimate. And then I think Karen can speak a little bit more about what goes on the site.
Yeah, I would add to that. I mean, slight alarm bells rang in that for me. And sorry to mention brand names, but I would say you should go to homeaway.co.uk or .com. And if you're looking for a local version of that, there would be a flag in the top right-hand corner where you can choose your local market. So you can choose whether you're in the US or whether you're in Copenhagen. I think hearing someone from that lets through Holiday Lettings, which is a different brand, recommending a HomeAway Copenhagen, that sort of rings alarm bells to me because that could be, as John said, somebody setting up a site that could mask or look like ours. I think always go to just the main URL for the website that you're looking at. So if it's, say, Expedia, go to Expedia.com. Yeah. And then search through there. So always make sure that you're going to the main brand that you're looking for and book and pay online.
Yeah, just to be clear, and because I was obviously shortening things down, you know, I was careful to make sure that it was actually a legitimate site with links off the tourist board and things like that as well before I
I mean, allowing for that, that's very surprised to find 27% of holiday scam victims say that they've only realised that they've been scammed after they've arrived. Which is, I mean, presumably when they turn up on the phone, I'm sorry, you're not booked in here at all, basically. We don't have any kind of reservation in any way, shape or form. Go away. Which can obviously, if you're talking about family holidays, let alone the sort of individual cost, be stressful. It can quite clearly destroy the holiday. John, are there top tips that you would actually recommend other than check the legitimacy of the site?
Well, one of the top tips of advice I can give is if the deal is too good to be true, it's probably a false deal. Mm-hmm. So don't let that too good of that good deal ruin your summer holiday. And another advice I would give is if you're using and you're traveling and you try to book your next holiday rental, maybe you're on the go and you use a public Wi-Fi, make sure you use a VPN in order to connect. And use the payment portal from the site. I think Karen.
Yeah, I'd add two main tips. I'd say, as John said, always use the legitimate website and book and pay online. And the second thing I would say is always make sure that you message through the website that you're using. So what I mean by that is if you see a photo, for example, which would have an email address and a phone number saying email us or phone us, I'd never do that because then you're not sure whether you're actually booking through that site. And that's a core thing that cyber criminals try to use. So the example you're giving of people turning up, that was where they haven't booked and paid or messaged through the platform. So that's the main thing you need to do to stay safe.
John, have you ever encountered things where you've, in your capacity as head of cyber investigations at McAfee, been just completely staggered at perhaps, shall we say, the ignorance of people in terms of what they've actually done? Or when it comes to cybercrime, is this one of the reasons fraudsters tend to benefit? Because ultimately human beings can be very silly.
In my experience within McAfee is that every human being, as good as you can be, everybody can be tricked.
Mm.
Honestly, I find myself very diligent, but who knows? Maybe I can be tricked as well. One interesting anecdote comes to mind, but I was more it wasn't what I encountered in my professional career, but I read it in the news that during the Champions League finals or the semifinals, I'm from Amsterdam, a UK supporter went to Amsterdam and booked a holiday rental, so as he thought. The pictures looked a little bit, vague, but apparently, eventually it turned out he booked a shipping container with just a bed.
You see, that's Tottenham fans for you. You know, at the end of the day, they go against Ajax. They're going to have challenges from that point of view. So, you know, I'm sure Liverpool didn't have the similar routine when they went over to Madrid, but maybe they did. Who knows?
And I have to say that shipping container hotel near Waterloo in London just looks so terribly interesting. I'm tempted to, find an excuse to go and look around because
maybe it's another way for HomeAway to consider shipping containers, Karen. It's just a thought, you know. It's sort of another branch of the business, or maybe not. Put it in the possibilities. Maybe. It's been awesome sharing some thoughts with your good selves today. Mm. Websites. Where can people go to find out further information? First of all, John, about McAfee and indeed the things we've been talking about today.
People can always visit McAfee.com.
Mm-hmm. And Karen, presumably same thing with respect to HomeAway?
Yeah, if you go to homeaway.co.uk and look for our book with confidence guarantee.
Karen Mellons, travel expert from HomeAway, and John Fokker, head of cyber investigations at McAfee. We salute you. Stay cyber safe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
revealed it's been announced, and in the UK's top 100 restaurants, Moor Hall in Lancashire is National Restaurant of the Year. However, even more good news, 46 of the UK's top 100 restaurants are from outside of London. And to actually talk about the awards and how actually we're heading into a special month as far as June and restaurants are actually concerned, who better than the editor of Restaurant Magazine and indeed the judge, Stefan Chomka. Good morning, Stefan. How are we?
I'm fine, thank you. How are you?
Very good indeed. Now, Stefan, talk to us about what makes a good restaurant in terms of this, and why was it in particular that Moor Hall has actually trumped the whole range of things? It's beaten Brat, it's beaten Cornerstone, it's come in at number one as far as the restaurant of the year.
Yeah, so what makes a good restaurant? It's a good question. I think a number of factors, really. I mean, food is obviously incredibly important, but it's more than just the food. It's the way it makes you feel. It's the service. It's the staff. It's the whole ambiance to a restaurant that really makes you want to come back time and time again, or feel really special. And I think in Moor Hall's case, it completely ticks all those boxes. I mean, it's a beautiful restaurant. It's in a fantastic location. But the food is amazing. It's ambitious. The service is great, but it's not stuffy. It's very relaxed. Mark Birchall's cooking is just it's almost perfect at times. It's just a really fantastic experience, which is why this year it's claimed the top spot.
Well, I know that our regular weekly food critic, of course, William Sitwell, has got lots of views when it comes to restaurants and so on, as you'd expect. But it seems as though you're very much showing that Moor Hall ticks all the boxes from this point of view. What about the other line, though, that actually restaurants around the country are getting better and better?
They are. I mean, I think what this Australia Dam Top 100 restaurants list shows is that there are more and more restaurants that are outside of London that are being recognised. I mean, I think it's fair to say that there have always been great restaurants outside of London. But I think, if you go back 10, 15 years, they've been of a certain kind of style. They've been very kind of Michelin star in ambition. They've been quite traditional. They've been quite, fancy and French for the people that wanted to tick off the place in the Red Book. But now, over the last 5, 6, 7 years, you're seeing a different type of restaurant opening up in the UK, but more ambitious, modern British. You're seeing chefs willing to leave London to open restaurants elsewhere in the country, and people willing to go out and try them. And what it's created is a really vibrant, interesting food scene across the country these days.
Interesting to see that in other awards, the Chef to Watch, sponsored by Woods Food Service, went to Sally Abe, and Chef of the Year, sponsored by Rita Fresh, went to Claire Smith. So obviously the notion of gender bias, that's changing as well, with female chefs taking 3 coveted top 10 spots.
I think it is. I mean, I think women are still heavily underrepresented in restaurants. It's still it's predominantly a male industry, but it is changing. There are some great chefs. There are some great female chefs working in the industry. There are some great female chefs running restaurants. And I think what as we see here, 3 female chefs in the top 10, all fantastic restaurants. Very different restaurants. And as you say, Claire Smith is a fantastic chef, and obviously a great, worthy winner of Chef of the Year. And Sally, the Harwood Arms has come. It's always been fantastic, but she's really moved the needle on further with her cooking there, and showing that women have a lot to offer the restaurant industry.
Stefan, we've spoken to editors before who've actually been involved with film criticism. They've had movies to judge and so on. We've had, obviously, for the country shows, people actually have to judge whether equine dressage and all sorts of other things, and cattle and various beasts are in force. When you are judging a restaurant of the year from that point of view, do you have a checklist? Do you go in anonymously? What was the sort of format that you actually went through? Or was it a case of, oh, no, Stefan's coming, we've got to be on our best behaviour?
Well, in fact, so how this list actually works is that we actually have an academy of more than 200 industry experts, and these are chefs, restaurateurs, critics, food writers, foodies, and kind of they do the judging for us. And so we ask them to name their favourite restaurant experiences over the past 12 months, and then we collate all the data and put it together to create the list. But I think, As regards to checklist, I think a restaurant to give you a truly exceptional experience must tick a number of boxes. It must make you feel great. The service must be fantastic. The food must be fantastic. It must just give you that experience that I suppose stands out from, you know, from all the other experiences. You know, I eat out an awful lot, so I have I have lots to compare it to. But you know, there are definitely those three or four meals that you have every year that just for numerous reasons just stick out more than anywhere else.
Now, we mentioned at the start that we are now in National Restaurant Month. It's running from the 11th of June until the 10th of July. So talk to us a bit about that, Stefan.
So National Restaurant Month is we've got together with a number of restaurants on the list, and throughout National Restaurant Month they are offering diners, you know, offers at their restaurant. So I think the best way to do it is to visit our newly created website, which is www.nationalrestaurantawards.co.uk. There's the whole list of the 100 restaurants. You can click on them and see the restaurants and see all the beautiful food that's there. And if you book through the website, there's plenty of offers available for that these top 100 restaurants are offering, which gives people a chance all over the country in this month to go out and try some of these great restaurants, you know, with some good offers to go for.
Yeah, I noticed that Mr. Blumenthal's Fat Duck is in at number 58, actually, so interesting from that point of view. What's the level of competitiveness? Because I get a sense that obviously we know that chefs can be very competitive, but it's the same with respect to Restaurant of the Year, that if you're not in the top 10, you're nowhere.
I think there is an element of competitiveness, and I think, you know, it's great to be just, you know, in this top 100. There are so many fantastic restaurants out there. There are loads of brilliant restaurants that didn't make the list. But I think, you know, when you're in that 100, you know, you want to be as high as you can. You know, people have been in there in the past and they've fallen out of the top 10, and that gives them the impetus to want to get back into the top 10. So yeah, you're right. Chefs, restaurateurs, they are a competitive bunch, and I think a list like this, you know, keeps them on their toes a little bit.
Well, there we are. Can only good news for the discerning diner, of course. In terms of size, just of a restaurant, does it really matter in terms of what size you actually are? Could it be anything from literally just a nice small, you know, 10 or 12 accommodating sort of routine right the way through to a major thing? Was there any criteria in terms of the size of restaurant?
So no criteria at all. So I mean, I think what this list also shows is the great diversity in the kind of restaurants that are on this list. So you have, you know, you have, I mean, a really good example is somewhere like, you know, at number 25 you have the Ritz, which is obviously a huge opulent dining room, one of the most, you know, fabulous dining rooms in the country. And then two places down you have Braun, a tiny little kind of restaurant in Hackney. I mean, the restaurants couldn't be further apart from each other. One very big and grand, one very small and humble and low key, but you know, both doing what great restaurants do, which is, you know, make the diner and the customer just have a fantastic time. It shows that, you know, it doesn't matter how big you are, how small you are, what kind of food you're doing. A great restaurant is a great restaurant.
I was also quite pleased not to see any franchise elements in there as well in terms of fast food. No, please, just step away from that. It would not be useful at all to have that side of things. Maybe that's another award system. Stefan, it's been awesome sharing some thoughts with your good self today. Where can people go to online to find out further details? If you kindly remind us?
So if you visit www.nationalrestaurantawards.co.uk, there's the full rundown of the top 100, some lovely photographs of all their food, and then you can click through and book through there and get eating.
Well, we clearly have two final questions that we need to ask just to make sure that we maintain our league position and so on. Stefan Chomka, editor of Restaurant Magazine, have you had a reasonably satisfying telephonic interview with us today? Has it been okay for you, sir?
It's been fantastic, thank you.
So coming for Vail upon you to join us again in the near future and keep us appraised of Restaurant Magazine and good eating experiences across the country.
Will do, thank you.
Stefan Chomka there, stepping into the William Slitwell slot in many ways. William, I'm sure, will return in the not-too-distant future, but let's put that question to the team. We've actually gone through the importance of cybersecurity so you avoid being scammed on holiday. We'll come back to that in a few moments, but let's turn to Holly. What for you makes a good restaurant, Holly?
I think, for me, it's the environment.
the environment. So if you've got an enjoyable... Themed restaurant, perhaps, you know, a geologist's restaurant, a geographer's restaurant.
Well, if you know any geography-themed restaurants, I'd like to know.
Right. We have lots of maps on the walls and things.
Yeah, it'd be great.
GPS to go table.
There's a really good one in London, which is the Rainforest Cafe.
Mm-hmm.
And the Rainforest Restaurant, and they actually have, like, animal sounds and thunderstorms and everything. It's fantastic. Excellent. I don't know if it's still open, but we went there.
Well, there's one. Emma, what for you makes a good restaurant?
Well, I like the dog cafes, so, you know.
Not cat ones. Not...
Oh, we've got a cat cafe opening in Lincoln.
Yeah, I've been to a cat cafe. I've actually been to one in Milan. It was a bit weird. They were Italian cats. But
they probably would be if they were Milanese.
But it was... I'm not a big fan of cats, so I'd rather go to a dog cafe. Yes. But otherwise, it's the food that
makes
it.
That's where dogs
are
actually present and allowed in as opposed to being served.
No, I was thinking the same thing.
Certain parts of the world, you could actually serve a dog cafe. Yes, I'll have two Pekingese and a Chihuahua, please. Couldn't eat a whole
That'd
one.
That'd be great.
Oh, my. Well, you may say it's great. There are many people actually listening who might sort of say, you canine hater. Yeah, just work on that basis. Unless, of course, you're renting them. Fergus, what about yourself?
I think atmosphere is the most important thing. Like, I like the old kind of rustic kind of gastropubs, kind of like, well, they're kind of the in the kind of the country,
like,
so
the Fat
kind
Duck
of,
which featured number 58 in this particular
I haven't experienced it, so I don't know, I can't really judge, but okay. They obviously judged it as being in the middle, I guess, but middling. Who knows.
And Joe,
Well, I've got two young kids, so...
You've said that several times.
I know, it's kind of a big...
They won't forget, don't worry.
It defines your life, yeah.
Yeah, it defines my life pretty much. So every time we plan to go out somewhere, you have to factor that in.
Yeah.
So anywhere that doesn't take 2 hours to serve your food is really good. So I do, I've been saying I like buffets because you can just go in, sit down... And just eat when you feel like
it. And not a fast food franchise person, though.
Carvery's the nice. Same kind of. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, some really nice Carvery places in Lincoln.
Buffets are also great if you're a picky eater.
They are.
Yeah.
Well, once again, Holly is actually, she scores. Coming up, we actually will be speaking to another two fine folks, Sir Hugh Ord, who is actually a security expert and former president of the Association of Chief Police Officers. And we also got Global Chief Security Architect from Unisys, that's Salvatore Sino, talking, strangely enough, about how British security concerns some of the lowest in the world. We just don't care at all these days. Hey ho.
You are gonna do.
Eddie and the Hot Rods might have been saying, do anything you want to do. But when it comes to adversity, international unrest, cyber security and so on, it seems we just don't care in Britain. UK ranking fourth lowest out of 13 countries on security concerns. But nevertheless, there are still new concerns being raised over security at large summer events and indeed smart device privacy. Now, to talk about this, as promised, we've got two fabulous folk. First of all, security expert and former president of the Association of Chief Police Officers. That's the wonderful Sir Hugh Ord. How are you, Sir Hugh?
I'm very well, thank you.
Excellent. And we also have Global Chief Security Architect from Unisys. That's Salvatore Sino. Good morning, Salvatore.
Good morning.
Excellent. Let's come to you first, Hugh, if we may. Were you surprised by these findings? Is it a case of, well, you know, when it comes to sporting events, summer festivals and so on, we don't really worry about security because nothing's going to really happen?
Well, no, I don't think that's what the survey undertaken by Unisys tells us. And what's interesting is it's showing a trend. This survey has been going on now since 2007, if I remember correctly. So we can pick up trends. And it's showing a drop in the concern about large events, if you like, global events or global atrocities or certainly national security, which in a way I understand because citizens don't, it doesn't affect citizens on a day-to-day basis. That doesn't mean they're not being sensible about it. It means they're not hugely concerned. Where they are concerned, and interestingly in your area, 94% of people in the region showed they were concerned, is about misuse of their personal information. I think that reflects issues which they feel they have more personal to them and they have less control over, you know, the development of smart devices, for example.
So, Salvatore, is it a case that ultimately, I mean, all four of the Madrid drivettes in the studio today have all been busily sort of looking at their cyber devices and various other bits of it so they could be hacked, they could be also, is that a fear that ultimately that kind of taking away and identity theft and all the kind of nightmare things that we've heard of, is that the thing that really gives us sleepless nights?
Well, one element that emerges from our research is there is one area where concerns are increasing, and this is internet security and concern about the personal information that can be misused. So about 49% of people interviewed expressed a serious concern about this, about that smart device and mobile phones can be used to steal personal details. Of course, there is an element of truth in this because these are devices that for their nature are distributed. They are part of a large network as the Internet of Things, and often we don't understand, we don't know how to properly secure them and connect to the right service provider. So we can apply some basic security rule and be security savvy. So, for example, always keep up to date with the security antivirus, security patches and updates. Always use a strong password as much as possible. But there is another element that is the human element, and so remember to not share your personal information on social media, social site, and never respond to email or call where they ask for your personal details or bank details and so on.
Okay, let's open it up, folks. I noticed you were quite interested in the story, making various notes and so on. Any thoughts from yourself?
I was just thinking, what would you say is the reason for the kind of contrast between the kind of lowering level of concern in regards to national security, but the increase in concern in regards to personal security? Is it because people are primarily more concerned with themselves, or would you get to explain that?
Are we intrinsically selfish, Sir Hugh? Is that what
it's about? No, it's not about being selfish. It's about being pragmatic and sensible. And I think, you know, people know there is, of course, a global threat, a national threat. There are, sadly, still people out there determined to cause damage to innocent people through their terrorist attacks. But we haven't seen that in the United Kingdom very recently. And that's mainly because of the work of the security services and the police across the country to keep people safe through disruption and arrest of those who may or may not be, who may be planning these events. Of course, if what you can control or what you are more concerned about because you use it every day and you read about it every day is the internet, you will get a phishing email asking you for your details, saying, you know, they've got a delivery, can you just confirm X or can you confirm Y, or your bank account's been compromised, ring this number immediately and give us your PIN. People understand that because it happens to them. And I think what we're seeing as the Internet of Things grows, and you now see personal assistants are the routine in many houses, not mine, I have to say, but in many houses, you know, that's another device, which is, of course, by definition, listening all the time. It's not communicating all the time. It's listening all the time. And people are becoming more aware of that and becoming more concerned.
You've got your Alexa, you've got your Cortini, you've got your Siri, you've got a whole variety of things there. We're at the University of Lincoln, obviously, Siren's home base here. Let's move to Holly, if we may. Holly, any thoughts from yourself? Are you concerned about this?
I mean, yeah, it is a concern. I think I'm maybe not as concerned as I should be about it, but... yeah, I understand why it's such a...
And again, as staff, and so Josephine will attest to this, we regularly get phishing alerts from our IT security staff, etc., and they seem to be getting cleverer and cleverer.
They do, yeah. And in terms of like listening in and things like that, I think I seem to have a much more relaxed attitude to that, because we were discussing it, weren't we, a while ago. It literally doesn't bother me if you have security cameras on every corner, if somebody wants to listen to my calls. It actually doesn't bother me. But apparently, like most people, it does. I don't know why it doesn't bother me.
Is Josephine a little unusual there, so here, or is it just a case of, well, you know, we can easily move to a totally surveillance society?
Well, she is very laid back. I understand that, and I think because these are so normal now, certainly to the younger generations, people don't see it in a threatening way. The risk, of course, and you know, we even have smart fridges now, never mind smart televisions. The risk, in a way, is the connectivity. So if you have your devices are all connected by definition, and your internet link is compromised, or you don't have a smart password, you know, that's one of the ways in. So other people can listen into conversations you may not want them to hear. So I think it's about being aware. I think it's about having sensible, pragmatic security measures in place, which are not that complicated to do without interfering with your normal way of life. It's a balance. And there's a spectrum from very laid back to absolutely paranoid. And I think the trick is to get somewhere in the middle. But, you know, you could run the risk of having your bank account compromised, for example. You could run the risk of having your identity stolen. And if you listen to victims of those sorts of crimes, they are very real crimes and very personal to them. So it makes sense to be sensible, pragmatic, and take basic measures.
I think I'd endorse those words of advice, even though the notion of a 24/7 reality TV show featuring a PhD student in geography has got its own sort of line from that point of view. Anyway, celebrated her birthday yesterday, so all the day before, so great stuff as far as that's concerned. Where can people go to find out further information about maybe some of the advice tips we've been talking about today?
Well, obviously the UNIS's website will give you far more detail about the global issues, and I think that's very useful to your PhD students, including geography. At a more precise level, every police force has a website. Every police force puts out crime prevention advice, and they're normally connected to Action Fraud, which is a national body that will update you on the latest scams that they're picking up. You know, I get the alerts through my local police force because I've joined their neighbourhood watch scheme, and I would encourage people to do that because it's a proactive way of letting you know what might be coming onto your inbox on a daily basis, you know, the latest scam on bank fraud, the latest scam on deliveries or whatever it is. So people are kept up to speed. So that's really important. And those are the best places to start your search.
Sir Hugh Ord and indeed Salvatore Lucino, many thanks indeed. And let's ensure that hopefully we stay safe and more importantly, cyber safe as the years proceed. We'll be right back. said that if you're true to your teeth, it won't be false to you. And in an era where actually there really is no excuse for not brushing regularly and so on, it seems that actually many people aren't, many children aren't. And children are indeed suffering from bad dental health at a fairly young age. Now, to talk about this, we're delighted to welcome two fine individuals. First of all, Professor Liz Kelly, president of the leading Oral Health Foundation. Good morning, Liz.
Good morning. It's Liz Kay, actually.
Okay, that's fine. And also Dr. Oshena Okoye,
Hello,
Oral-B Smile Director, which is wonderful. Now, Dr. Okoye, if we can come to you first, is this something which is becoming more and more of a problem and a challenge as the weeks go by?
With regards to kids and suffering from problems? Yes. I mean, it's quite shocking because they did the first survey of three-year-olds, usually it used to be five-year-olds, and they found that by three, 12% of kids had teeth decay, which is just completely crazy. And so a lot of work needs to be done. In this day and age, we shouldn't be having our kids, you know, having tooth decay, having pain, having cavities. So that's why Oral Health Foundation and Oral-B together, they have done this research for National Smile Month to just try and explore kids' brushing habits and see what we can do to improve and help prevent this disease.
Yeah, I mean, Liz, from your own perspective, clearly the argument against fluoridation was hopefully sorted out a good few years ago. But are we still seeing people concerned about how we're not using fluoro, we're not using it, or is it just a case of peer pressure or parentals suffering as a result of pester power?
The cause of decay is sugar, so the pester power is obviously crucially important. But also there's the background advertising and a whole culture of that sweet is good, it's associated with love, etc., etc., etc. And we've got to move away from that because that is the cause of tooth decay, as well as being the cause of many other diseases, diabetes, heart disease, etc., etc. It's connected with all these chronic diseases. And if we can nip that habit in the bud when people are tiny, they will live healthier lives, both for their oral health but also for their general health.
Well, certainly one of the strap lines we've been using quite extensively over the last few years with our nutritional aspects is that sugar is the new nicotine, and maybe actually we need to address that issue as well, because that was something else that used to be given a fairly positive spin when it came to advertising and so on. Brings us neatly around to the other question: how can we then actually, as parents, bring in more fun to ensure that children actually enjoy the experience, as opposed to suggesting it's just a chore and they have to brush twice a day because they have to?
Eugenia will talk about that because she's got a three-year-old.
Yes, who I struggle with. I keep reminding her that her mum is a dentist, so she should let me brush her teeth. Doesn't go down well. I think from my perspective, for my patients, I recommend the Oral-B electric toothbrush. So from 3 years old, it removes plaque so much better than anything even I as a dentist can do, because you're struggling with these strong-willed children and it does the job for you. You literally just place it on the teeth. It's fun. They have a Disney Magic app that sings songs, because most songs are about 2 minutes long. So that's a good way to keep them there. And as parents, you know, our job is to try and build good habits so that if it becomes part of their routine and they understand why they're doing it, then hopefully we can prevent them being in pain and creating fear. Me personally, I'm a dental phobic, which everyone finds hilarious, but I had a tooth extracted when I was about 7 with no anaesthetic. So even now as a grown-up, I am not a fan of the dentist, and I don't want any child to have to experience that.
Very much so. Now, where can people actually find out more details about the campaign for National Smile Month and more? Where would you suggest they should head off to?
Okay, for National Smile Month, www.smilemonth.org, or contact the Dental Health the Oral Health Foundation at www.dentalhealth.org. And there's a helpline also, which they'll find on that website.
And also to get some tips on how to make the oral care routine more fun, you can go on to oralb.co.uk.
Exactly. I think the days of using the www, apart from being a bit of a tongue twister, is probably the sort of best of one side. Liz and Oshena, many thanks indeed, and keep smiling.
We will. Have a wonderful day.
You see, I'm not sure about singing toothbrushes. I mean, what about the Sitwell household? I mean, are you ones for singing toothbrushes to sort of burst into song, Disney or otherwise, whilst you're brushing your teeth, William?
No.
No, exactly. I think, you know, I mean, sometimes it just goes crazy. The top 100 restaurant list was revealed this week, and according to Restaurant Magazine, Moor Hall in Lancashire was crowned National Restaurant of the Year, with 46 of the UK's top 100 restaurants apparently being outside of London. William, the question we've been putting to our team this morning and to others is, what makes a good restaurant? Now, you are the Telegraph's number one go-to guru, and indeed anyone's go-to guru when it comes to the right restaurant to find. So what for you effectively scores highly and makes that good restaurant?
Well, let me firstly say that the idea of having to have an app to get people to brush their teeth is pathetic. Just tell them to brush their teeth and get on with it.
Well said, well said.
That, you know, we're not going to the restaurant unless you brush your teeth. That's a good one. You know, we shan't be dining in a Michelin-starred restaurant this evening if you don't brush your teeth.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
As to your question, there's so many things. You know, it's the buzz, it's the decor, it's the food, it's the service. There are a few places in the world that get it absolutely right. So you've also got to be there at the right time. You've got to be in a good spirit yourself. There's a sort of magic buzz that the great restaurants get right. And if everyone knew what it was, we would be filled with amazing restaurants as a result, because it's such a complex thing. It's tough, and there aren't so many absolutely brilliant places. But I think at the end of the day, if you're a restaurateur yourself, you've got to have passion. You've got to genuinely believe in what you're doing. You've got to be, you know, not do it for purely commercial reasons. You've got to really believe in it and have passion.
We're chatting in the programme with a couple of our PhD students who are here. As Joe, who I don't think, Josephine, you've actually met the awesome William Sitwellers yet, have you?
I haven't, no.
No, Josephine, doing a PhD in the joys of geography. Is it just geography, or is it something more than that? Because it's, I mean, PhD, you have a type, you know, a specific sort of zone. What's the official title that we would say?
Oh, the title itself is like, it's a really long one, so I can never remember the whole thing off by heart.
Postgraduate students aren't what they used to be, William, I don't know, these days. They can't even remember the studies that they're actually doing, but still, never mind.
You can't even remember the course you're on.
Exactly. It's tricky, isn't it? Yeah, it's looking at flood frequency analysis.
Flood frequency analysis, yeah. Exactly.
That's very good, yeah.
And Holly, your ideal restaurant, of course, as we were finding out, as well as pursuing your geography routine, would be something which is geographic in orientation.
I think when I said environment, I meant sort of, well, I mean, I'd love a geography-themed restaurant. I think for me, that would be incredible. But in terms of environment, I meant
the atmosphere.
Right. Yeah.
Okay, well, we can go with that. I mean, William, have you ever encountered
the great,
any?
The great restaurant critic Adrian Gill said once that if the most important thing is the food, you're in the wrong place. And if you only focus on producing beautiful food, but no one's having a good time, it's pointless. You can go to places where the food's pretty terrible, but you have an amazing time. So, you know, it takes everything coming together. I don't quite know what a geography-themed restaurant would be. What is that sort of pyramidal peaks and ribbon development? I don't know how that manifests itself in a restaurant, even a restaurant themed with flood frequency analysis.
Live volcanic eruptions, earthquakes when you sat there, that sort of thing.
I can see you thought
onion,
this through.
Onion skin weathering.
Yeah, I like that one.
it could happen. A whole new world could manifest itself in an Aladdin way. How is the book writing coming on, William? Because we haven't asked you for a few weeks. Is it beginning to take shape?
It is. You're very kind to ask, yes.
Excellent.
I just need to spend more time doing it and less time trying to earn a living, which is a struggle.
But at the same time, when you can actually post the Michael Gove number about Columbia, I mean, great hilarity has ensued from that point of view. She's marvellous. Okay, Emma, any thoughts or questions you'd like to put to William? Because obviously his number one fan as far as our student population is concerned, soon-to-be graduate, of course, Ben Lewis, is currently looking for somewhere to live in London.
Yeah, he is. He's not here. I was just wondering, like, do you think that sometimes it's memories behind a restaurant that make it one of your favourites? Because I think there are sometimes restaurants that stick out in my mind, but it's because of how you were feeling when you went there, or maybe where you were, or, you know, the moments and the memories behind it, rather than the food sometimes.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. It's very much part of that, and it's also, you know, the people that you're with, the experience that you're having. Nigella Lawson always talks about this idea of fake nostalgia, the idea that we create moments and memories that don't actually exist. We hark back to things that didn't really happen. And I think that, you know, the memory is such an extraordinary thing that we can think back and sort of add layers of experience to an event that we've sort of managed to massage in time, and that creates sort of an extra dimension to it. And then you go back to that place and it's never the same. So, I think there's a lot of psychological aspects to our appreciation of eating out. And also there's so much to it because, you know, you eat with your eyes, with your ears as well, the texture, the flavor, there's so many different things. So it's very complex. I think you should quit whatever you're doing and do an analysis of what makes the best restaurant.
There we are, that's sorted. And in case you're wondering, the slight little whistle there is because Emma's demonstrating the wrong way to weigh headphones on the air, keeping one side closer to the actual microphone because they howl around there. It's okay. Sometimes basic Radio 101, we work our way through it and we leave it for Radio 5 Live. William, it has been awesome as ever connecting with your good self. Fergus, we will occupy your good self now for a few moments to ask William those awesome last two questions, please.
So, William, has it been a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us today?
Yeah, it was. I wish Ben would get off my floor. He can't stay here any longer. Yes.
Yeah, we'll pass on to him. He'll be at the Lincolnshire Show with us next week, William. So will you be kind enough to return in, let's say, 2 weeks from now?
I might be away, but try me. Well, it might be somewhere.
All part of the rich tapestry of life with William Sitwell, a man, a writer, a political pundit, a satirist, I mean, generally a Renaissance man, William.
Great. Well, I'm glad that one of the good things about me is the fact that I'm a man. Interesting.
Yeah. Exactly. You know, we tell it like it is. Featuring Labyrinth with To Be Human. And we now say thanks to Gabriella Peralta, Richard Fitzwilliams, Ian Lennox, Graham Sands, Pablo Shah, Stefan Chomka, Professor Fiona Moore, John from Holiday Scams, Liz Kay, Chenna, of course, Ace Dentist, William Sitwell, Sir Hugh Ord and Salvatore. And in the studio, Fergus Jeffs, have you found the last couple of hours, well, I don't know, some kind of vague, interesting level at all?
Yeah, it's been pretty interesting, yeah.
It's your second show, Josephine Westlake. First morning show. How have you found the whole experience?
Again, that was quite tricky. But apart from that, yeah, it's been fantastic. I've really enjoyed it, so looking forward to doing some more radio.
And have you got a name for the science podcast-based show that we're working on? Has anything been emerging as yet?
No, not yet.
Nothing
will,
as yet,
we
still?
We will update you, but we're really excited, aren't we? Science.
The equivalent of past prologue, but for science as opposed to history. It's great. Coming soon on Siren Radio. Holly, have you enjoyed your first show on the production so far?
I have, yeah. I think there's been some interesting discussions going on. So, yeah.
Listen again, of course, outsidebroadcasting.podbean.com. It'll be up as a downloadable feature in about, say, 80 minutes from now. Probably even less. Emma, fashionably late. Nice stuff. Are you ready for the Lincolnshire Show next week?
I am, and I won't be fashionably late for that.
I'd like to hear it. You know, very good. It is National Smile Month, so we will wrap up with Or should we actually just say Happy Premier League Fixtures Release Day?
I mean, it's quite a month.
I'm out of four, yeah.
All right, let's just say Happy National Smile Month. One, two, three.
Happy National Smile Month.